Hi, I'm Sean Canaan. It's 11:06 in the morning, and this is WMNF Tampa. This hour, we're going to hear the BBC News Hour, and I'll be back at noon for Midpoint. Rob Lori's last day at WMNF was last Friday, and because this is a personnel matter, it won't be appropriate for us to say anything further, but here is the BBC News Hour joint in progress.
925. Do let us know what you're up to. Well, let's start with what a top Chinese disease control official has said about China's coronavirus vaccines. At a press conference at the weekend, the official, Dr. Gao Fu, said the efficacy of the vaccines was low. Since then, though, he said that his comments were misinterpreted. Let's speak to Kerry Allen, who works for BBC Monitoring and looks at the media coming out of China. Hi, Kerry.
Hi, James.
Right. What did he say? And what does he now say that he really meant?
Well, he very much said that vaccines in China don't have very high rates of protection. And he made comments about potentially mixing COVID-19 vaccines as a way of boosting their effectiveness. But now what's happened is there's been an exclusive interview given with China's national newspaper Global Times, in which he said that what he was doing was offering a scientific vision that in order to improve the effectiveness of vaccines, there could be adjusted vaccination procedures. And he said that vaccines all around the world are sometimes high and sometimes low. So he's saying that what he said was taken out of context. So some people are seeing this as a U-turn in what he's been saying.
It's a really helpful phrase, isn't it, for politicians, public officials, taken out of context.
Exactly, yes. He's now saying that this was a complete misunderstanding and really enforcing that there is not a problem with Chinese vaccines, because obviously this is going to have a very unsettling opinion, not only to people within China, but also around the world. I mean, there are more than 60 countries at the moment that are using Chinese vaccines, and there are at least 80 that China says it's helped provide vaccines to, which is nearly, would that be like half the world?
Gosh, if there are about 200 odd territories, 193, I think, members of the UN, that's getting there, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
And what do we know inside China about China's vaccines and also the vaccination program within the country itself?
Well, it's been running now for a number of months. It was one of the first countries to launch vaccination. China's had at least three vaccines that are being used. There are a number that are still in phase three trials. So there are a number of vaccine candidates. We know now, we get daily statistics, that more than 167 million doses have been given within mainland China. So it's second in the world after the US in terms of the number of vaccine doses. We also know that hundreds of millions have been given to other countries around the world. So a considerable amount, not just China, but also other countries. And particularly within China, the people who are receiving these vaccines are actually, it's very different to, just looking at the UK, for example, where I am, it's not the elderly that are being prioritised. So the majority of people who are actually receiving vaccines in China are in the 18 to 59 years of age category. And as a result, China's not got enough data, particularly on the elderly. So its vaccines like Sinovac and Sinopharm have not yet got World Health Organization authorization. There's been questions about data transparency.
I'm really fascinated to understand what's being talked about in Chinese language social media. Are people allowed to say, look, I'm a little bit scared about the efficacy of this vaccine?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And actually, this is something that national media have very much been covering in recent days, because just like, you know, human nature, a lot of people are scared about getting a vaccine, a jab. But also because China is largely back to normal, some people feel that they almost don't need a jab, because it's very much been the case since April 2020 that people in China could largely go about, you know, they could go clubbing again, they could go to bars, they could go to restaurants. So they almost feel like they've adjusted to a post-corona world for a long period of time. But at the same time, they've got officials very much telling them now, you know, this could happen again unless you get the vaccine.
If I was in Shanghai right now and I needed to go out to a nightclub in the evening, could I do so?
You could absolutely do so. Yeah, you could go anywhere. A lot of places have like a track and trace system in place. So you have a code on your mobile phone that you can scan that proves that you've not got the coronavirus or been in contact with anyone who's got the coronavirus. So there are still businesses that more or less kind of track that people are okay to enter their premises. But yeah, I mean, it's largely the case that people are not wearing masks in public. They feel safe. They can go anywhere. They can travel across the country. Yeah, it's life as normal very much, apart from one area in the southwest, a city called Rili, which is on the border with Myanmar. There are parts of that city at the moment that are under lockdown due to recent cases. But anywhere else, it's life as normal.
Kerry Allen, as always, thank you so much. Well, one of the countries relying on China's vaccines is Chile. It's got one of the highest vaccination rates in the world so far. But puzzlingly, it's also experiencing a surge in cases. How do we work this out? Let's speak to Paula Molina, a radio host and podcast editor at Radio Cooperativa Chile. She joins us live from Santiago. Hi, Paula.
Hi, James.
Please help me out. Something we're all trying to understand. I've read a number of articles about this. Chile's vaccinated huge numbers of people, but infections have been rising. Why is that?
Yes, actually more than or around 45% of Chilean population already got the vaccine. So what is going on here in Chile? And I think we're going through probably the worst days of the pandemic here, even worse than in 2020, because of a number of measures that we're not taking during our summer months, January, February, and March. During the summer, the Chilean summer, people were allowed to travel from city to visit friends and family after, you know, long lockdowns. The airports remain open, and there were flights from and to Brazil, which probably helped to create these circulations of variants of the virus, which are more contagious the original one. So that's part of the explanation, I guess.
And Paolo, what about the Chinese vaccines? Chile's been relying heavily on these vaccines. I saw one study from the Universidad de Chile, which said that after a first dose, the protection was really very, very small.
Yes, yesterday there was so much alarm in Chile, and you could read it on social networks, you could see it on TV, after the words from China about the efficacy of the Sinovac vaccine. The fact is that we always knew there was this around 50-56% of efficacy in controlling the cases of COVID. What we rely on is that 100% efficacy in avoiding more the worst cases, you know, those that need require hospitalization. But I think that's part of the mixed, confusing messages that the population has been hearing from the government. Back in the summer again, there was this idea that vaccination was the cure for everything. And definitely, no vaccine works in this pandemic if you don't keep on some important measures like wearing masks or keeping social distance.
If there's one thing I should just say, Paula, I used to live in Chile. And if there's one thing I remember about January, February, March, is that the entire country moved either to the beach or down south to the lakes. It was really, and I couldn't phone anyone. Everyone was off on holiday for about 3 months. But what essentially has the government been telling people?
Well, the government was announcing on February that maybe kids should go back to school in March. Actually, there was this strong message of going back to schools. And that was at the same time that many experts were warning of these rising cases. And as you know, James, as you tell us, exactly, people were traveling from one part to the other, and there was this, you know, you need to take protection, but at the end of the day, you can go for a few days out, you can go vacation if you want to.
What one thing we know about Chile's president, Sebastián Piñera, is that for decades and decades, he's been about the free market. Is he looking to get other vaccines, to buy other vaccines around the world, which are more effective than the 50-odd% which the Chinese vaccines are effective?
Well, that's a very interesting point, James, because actually this was this idea during the summer that the president was like an entrepreneur, you know, that he could, and he was doing this really great deals in getting these vaccines for Chile, which he did. And it was, of course, something good. But at the same time, maybe the president, who was under very low rates of popularity, was trying to boost, you know, the popularity, relying on these successful vaccination deals and process. And maybe that's part of the wrong message that we all as citizens were getting, no? Like, oh, we are a huge success. We are, again, and you know about this, James, the country that's different from the rest of Latin America.
I remember everybody telling me that when I was in Chile. The first thing anyone says is, we're very different from the rest of South America. Exactly. I heard that from so many dozens of Chileans.
Exactly. Well, so, you know, that's a very prevalent narrative in Chile. Like, Chile is this exceptional, different country, actually. Like, Chile is like, sorry to say this, but some say people, the British.
Yeah, almost everyone. We are the English of South America, they used to say. Paola, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. Paola Molina in Santiago. Thank you so much. One of the top trends on Twitter in the United States at the moment is Brooklyn Center. That's a city in the state of Minnesota. There's been unrest there overnight after a black man called Dante Wright was shot dead by the police. Brooklyn Center is just north of the city of Minneapolis, where you might already know George Floyd was killed last year by the police, and where one of the officers involved, Derek Chauvin, is currently on trial. Let's speak to Tim Nelson. He's a reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
What do we know about the death of 20-year-old Dante Wright?
Well, this started about 2 o'clock yesterday afternoon. As you said, police in Brooklyn Center encountered Mr. Wright. They pulled him over on what looked like a traffic violation to begin with. His mother contended later that he had claimed to have been pulled over because air fresheners were dangling from his rearview mirror in his car. At any rate, after they got him pulled over, it looks like they ran a check on his name and found a warrant for his arrest. They asked him to step out of the car and were preparing to arrest him. He apparently got back in the car. And at that point, at least one officer, we know that one officer opened fire, shot and hit him. He drove a short distance. We're not clear exactly how far, but crashed into another car there, where his girlfriend, who was in the car with him, was injured. When police got there, they started to render medical aid, but he died at the scene. We're not sure if it was the gunshot wound or the crash. They haven't released a cause of death yet, but obviously a great suspicion that you know, the police shooting had something to do with it there. And as it happened, his mother was on the phone with him during much of this, as this event unfolded, tried to actually talk to the officers there herself, said that she was trying to straighten out some paperwork with the police and her son, but to no avail. When she finally got a hold of the girlfriend, his girlfriend said that he'd been shot and was laying on the ground dead beside her.
Tim, if there was one thing that the state and the city of Minneapolis probably didn't want, was the death of another black man who'd been stopped by the police. How, in any way, might this affect the atmosphere surrounding the Derek Chauvin trial into the death of George Floyd?
Well, this is extremely bad timing, kind of the worst case scenario here. You know, as you said, the trial's going on. It's brought unprecedented attention to police conduct and use of force, not just for Minneapolis, but around the country. And just, you know, in the last week, people have been watching the video of Floyd's death play over and over and over again in graphic detail. I mean, sensitivity to these issues is at what feels like an all-time high. And we also know that this trial has been buffeted by outside events in the past. There was, as they were selecting jurors, the city of Minneapolis paid a $27 million civil settlement to Floyd's family, a deal that some sitting jurors found out about before testimony started and prompted the judge to replace them. So we're watching that trial very carefully as testimony resumes today to see if attorneys or the judge address this incident, to see if it makes an impression to the jury that they have to respond to.
And we will continue to follow that trial. Tim Nelson, thank you so much. This is OS on the BBC with James Reynolds. We're live from the BBC. Let's take a look at some of the other stories being worked on in our global newsrooms. One firefighter has died and two are seriously injured after a massive fire at a historic factory in Russia's second city, St. Petersburg. The fire quickly spread to all floors of the Nevsky Yar Manufaktura building. The building dates back to 1841 when it was used to manufacture fabric. It's an iconic landmark in St. Petersburg. South Africa's police are investigating the circumstances around the death of a 22-year-old woman, Anele Tembe, the fiancée of the popular rapper AKA. She's believed to have fallen from the 10th floor of a Cape Town hotel on Sunday. And as Britons mourn the death of Prince Philip, they're joined by a community on a Pacific island. For decades, two villages on the Vanuatan island of Tanna have revered the Duke of Edinburgh as a godlike spiritual figure. A formal period of mourning is now underway. Let's bring in our coronavirus expert for this hour to talk through some more of the day's stories on the pandemic. Dr. Eleanor Murray is Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health. Hello, Dr. Eleanor.
Hi, great to be here.
Great to have you. We're going to start with that Chinese vaccine story we've been covering. What's your understanding, in simple terms, of how well China's vaccines work?
So the Chinese haven't released really the results, the detailed results of the trials, but a number of studies have looked at countries where the vaccine has been used. And, you know, the estimates that have come out of those studies range around maybe the 50% efficacy level or a bit higher. So lower than some of the other vaccines, but not, you know, not as bad as, you know, not having a vaccine at all.
Why doesn't it release that kind of information? Isn't that the most basic thing of science, to release data?
Yeah, so, I mean, this has been something that, you know, a lot of people have been calling for, the release of the trial data. And, you know, I think people have been wondering, you know, why not release that? Was there a problem in the trial that, you know, they don't want people to see? But, you know, I think it's also, it may be that, you know, They did see, you know, if they did see efficacy at the level of, you know, 50% or something in that trial, that is pretty decent efficacy. It certainly was, you know, before we had the mRNA vaccines.
Isn't that part of the point, though, that let's say you're out there in the world, because it's not just China, this more than 60 countries have made deals with China. Why would you go for the one with about 50% efficacy when there are several others out there with, what, 80, 90% efficacy?
Yeah, so if the only consideration were, you know, what's the efficacy of the vaccine, you would absolutely want to go for the highest one you can. You know, realistically, the other consideration is how accessible are the vaccines to you. And, you know, it would be really nice to have the data from the trial so we can really evaluate what's going on with those, the Chinese vaccine. But, you know, if the efficacy is around 50%, it's certainly better than no vaccine at all. And it has been made available to countries that have not had the option to easily get the other vaccines.
And of course, you know, there will be people listening to OS who will have had one of the Chinese vaccines. What would you say to them? Should they be worried or should they be reassured by that 50%?
So, yeah, I mean, no vaccine is perfect, and none of the vaccines are going to be 100% effective in everybody. So I think, you know, the general advice that stands to, you know, people who've gotten vaccinated can, you know, be a little bit less cautious than they were before, but still do need to take precautions while COVID is circulating in their area, while there are a lot of cases in their area. And I think that holds true for any of the vaccines. You know, it seems like maybe the Chinese made vaccines, that this, you know, maybe is a little bit more true. So, you know, because the efficacy is probably a little bit lower, more around 50%, you know, you don't want to be going completely wild and having, you know, big parties and events and things like that. But if you were doing something that had, you know, risk of COVID exposure, you're now a bit protected, so it's a bit less risky. So I think, you know, certainly it should be reassuring to people who've gotten this vaccine that they are somewhat protected, even if they're not as protected as they could be.
talking about the virus circulating, let's also move to Brazil, about the variant first seen in that country. New research has shown that the majority of COVID patients in intensive care units in March in Brazil were under the age of 40. It's according to the Brazil ICU project. There were 11,000 people aged 39 or younger in intensive care in Brazil last month. What does this tell us, Doctor?
Yeah, so just based on that information, it's a little bit hard to unpack what that could mean, because it could be that, the P1 variant that was circulating in Brazil, makes younger people sicker than the other variants of coronavirus. And that's certainly, I think, the first conclusion a lot of people would come to. But it's also possible, while the ICUs are really overwhelmed, while COVID is really, really high in an area, if hospitals are having to do any kind of triage on who can get a scarce ICU bed, they may be, giving those beds to younger people because they expect that they have a higher chance to survive.
And what would happen to the older people? Would they go to hospital? Would they still be at home, left to die in some places?
I don't know for sure that that's what happened, but that's definitely a possibility that could have happened. Either they could have just been in, a hospital bed, but not getting that ICU level attention. They may have been sent home. This is sort of the reason that we've been all taking all these precautions, is that when the health systems get overwhelmed, these really hard choices just have to be made, because there are a limited number of beds, there are a limited number of trained medical workers that can take care of people this sick. And so, what we saw in Brazil is that cases were really out of control. And it's likely that there are at least some places where these decisions had to be made.
What's your sense of how Brazil might get it back under control?
So I think, what we've seen consistently is that restricting the number of contacts people have is, the best way to bring an outbreak under control. And that, generally means a lockdown that's pretty severe if cases are really out of control. And then once everybody's, locked down as much as possible, to only start opening up once cases are low, and once you're able to put in place a good testing, contact tracing system that helps you find people who are infected and keep those people isolated or quarantined.
And briefly, in a couple of sentences, the monitoring of the variant first seen in Brazil in other countries, how's that going?
So we are seeing it in some other countries. I don't know too much beyond that.
We don't expect everyone to know everything. Dr. Eleanor Murray, you did tell us about so much, China and Brazil. For that, we are entirely grateful. Dr. Murray is Assistant Professor of Epidemiology at Boston University School of Public Health. You're listening to OS from the BBC World Service.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the U.S. is supported by C3 AI. C3 AI software enables organizations to use artificial intelligence at enterprise scale, solving previously unsolvable business problems. C3 AI, this is enterprise AI. And Fidelity Wealth Management, helping clients develop tax-efficient investing strategies. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
Hello, this is James Reynolds, live at the BBC. In normal times, staying at a hotel for 2 weeks sounds quite fun. You get room service, someone else does your laundry, and if you just want to loll about, you get to hang a Do Not Disturb sign on your door. However, it is an awful lot different if you're in a hotel because of coronavirus quarantine. We'll be hearing from three women who are currently quarantining in hotels in New Zealand, Australia, and Indonesia. It was hard for them to decline our invitation to talk. They're not doing anything else.
BBC News with Justine Green. The Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny is said to have lost 15 kilograms since he was sent to a prison camp. Mr. Navalny is on hunger strike, but he's also accused the authorities of depriving him of sleep and proper medical treatment. Last year, the Putin arch critic was the target of a nerve agent poisoning. A new report says there are reasonable grounds to believe that the Syrian government used chemical weapons in an attack on the town of Sarakab in 2018. The International Chemical Arms Watchdog said a cylinder full of chlorine was used. The EU's police agency says organised crime is thriving in the COVID pandemic and that this could have serious long-term consequences. Europol said criminals were selling fake vaccines and testing kits and running complex fraud schemes. The agency said the threat from organised crime was higher than ever before. The Chinese authorities are restructuring one of the country's tech giants, the Ant Group. The online lending platform will become more like a traditional bank. The moves against the group have been linked to the Chinese leadership's distrust of its outspoken founder, Jack Ma. The German Christian Democrats have backed their leader Armin Laschet as the joint centre-right candidate to succeed Angela Merkel as chancellor. But their smaller Bavarian sister party, the CSU, is still hoping its leader Markus Söder will get the nomination. The Somali parliament has extended the mandate of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo by 2 years, despite an attempt by the Mogadishu police chief to suspend the session. The chief was swiftly sacked by the national police chief. Two of the Duke of Edinburgh's grandsons, William and Harry, have paid tribute to him. William calling the Duke an extraordinary man with a mischievous sense of humour. Both Houses of Parliament devoted their sessions to tributes to the Duke, who died on Friday. BBC News.
James Reynolds with you for this edition of OS. We're live on the BBC World Service. Later this half hour, we'll take you to a couple of states in India we haven't heard from recently as we tell the story of growing coronavirus case numbers there. Two reporters will help us to understand the situation, including one who's covering a giant religious festival where there is concern that huge crowds could contribute to the surge. Now, every weekday, around this time on OS, if you're a regular listener, you will know that we bring together people who have been affected by the coronavirus pandemic in different ways. In this edition, we're hearing from people in quarantine hotels. Many countries have brought in a hotel quarantine system whereby people arriving from abroad have to isolate in a hotel for a period of time. That can range from a few days up to 14 days. We brought together three women, all currently quarantining in various parts of the world. In a moment, you'll hear from Charlotte, who's from Australia, but she's in a hotel in New Zealand. She has to quarantine for 14 days. Unfortunately for her, she's only on day three. Still an awful long way to go. Then there's Michelle. She's on day 11 of her quarantine. She'll be out on Monday. She's in Brisbane, Australia. She travelled there from Northern Ireland, where she is originally from. Firstly, though, here's Amanda. She's Danish. She usually lives in Malaysia, but she's quarantining in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia. There, you only have to quarantine for 6 days. Amanda is nearing the end of her stay with just another night to go. She told my colleague Nuala McGovern about her hotel room.
I got a medium-sized room because I did want a little bit more space. Of course, it's a little bit extra money, but it's definitely been worth it because I've been able to sort of move around a little bit. And I've got a big window. It can't open, but I've got a huge window, which I get natural light from, so that's great. And then actually we can go down into, there's this like yard that we can go down. It's of course monitored, so like making sure people are wearing masks and keeping their distance, but actually it's quite nice to just, if you need to come outside a little bit. And in terms of the food, we can order food from outside. That was very important to me because they kind of just bring you food 3 times a day and you can't really choose from a menu. And I'm a vegan as well, so I didn't really know what they would sort of come up with. And yeah, it's definitely not great. Like, it's cold and it's not ideal, but you know, whatever. I have snacks. I brought snacks with me. It's fine.
I'm also a vegan, and I have to say the food here at my hotel has been fantastic, like really surprising actually. Before I came over, I read somewhere that someone was served a bun with lettuce and cucumber for their vegan meal, and I thought, oh gosh, I hope I don't get that, like that's not going to fill me. But the chef called me and arranged vegan alternatives, and I'm really fortunate as well because I'm from Australia. Everyone quarantining at the hotel that I'm at is also from Australia, so we're considered low risk. And we have been given wristbands and a card to leave the room for fresh air. We're also able to empty our own rubbish, so we can go for a daily walk to take our rubbish out. And it hasn't really hit me that I've been locked in just yet. It's just kind of new, and it's a bit of a novelty being in a hotel and being looked after and having food delivered and, yeah, that kind of thing.
I don't have any outside time. We're not allowed to leave our room, and I don't have a window to even open, or I don't have a balcony. So that's really, kind of really what concerns me. I like fresh air. I'm an outdoors person. I'm usually out every day. The food here is quite questionable. Three times a day we get our delivery, and the door knocks, and you have to wait 10 seconds before you can answer it. You have to answer it with a mask, and then your food comes, and sometimes it's just warm, not warm enough, and it's not the food that I would choose, although we did get a menu set, you know, 7 days in advance as well, but you can't choose what you want to order. It's just a set menu. But Nuala, you'll love this. I brought plenty of Barry's tea and potato, cheese and onion from home.
Oh, that's all you need. Yep. Woman can live on tea and potato alone. So I should say potato are kind of I should say that for our global listeners, Michelle, there, our Barry's is a brand of tea. There are other brands available. And Tato is a brand of potato crisps or chips, as our American listeners will know them. Yes. But many a person who has left the island will bring both items with them.
It's a must all the time.
So, Michelle, do you have any suggestions for me in regards to coping with boredom?
Oh, loads. Okay, so I've been watching a lot of Netflix, especially the first couple of days getting over the jet lag. Also, Spotify. I've been dancing and singing around the room like a silly person. Podcasts as well. I've been listening to quite a few podcasts. I have a few books as well. I've been reading a couple of books. Also, yeah, if you have any, you know, if you have any emails or phone calls to do, just get them all done and enjoy your time in the hotel.
Anything else you'd like to add, Amanda, perhaps, to help Charlotte get through the next 10 days?
Yeah, sure. Before coming here, I scheduled already lots of calls, like FaceTimes with my friends from around the world that I needed to catch up with. So I had someone, or I have someone to talk to every day for a few hours. And really what's been like my saving grace, because I'm a yoga instructor as well, so I do like to move my body and things. So I have a little space here next to my bed where I can like do my yoga, but also I'm like you, Michelle. Like, I've been dancing and I've been singing just because I need a little fun in my life. And I wish I could say I was a big reader, but I am more of a Netflix kind of gal. So that's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
Three of you are also positive. But I'd say a lot of our listeners, they hear you, they hear what you're going through, prepared to put up with, sacrifice, etc., because you needed to make a trip. And they're probably wondering why. Would it be okay to maybe run through? I know everybody has different reasons and backgrounds of why you needed to, you know, spend time in the quarantine hotel. Why did you have to travel? Who wants to start? Michelle, I think yours is a little sad, so I apologize for asking you.
Yeah, no, that's okay. My reason for flying back to Ireland from Australia was that my mum became quite sick quite fast. So I had to go home. I just had to be there, and I had to, just be there for her and everything. She's okay. She was slightly improving as I had to leave. Obviously, I couldn't stay there for too long. I was home for 7 weeks altogether. It was supposed to be 6 weeks, but then my flight got cancelled because Melbourne had closed completely to international arrivals. So I managed to get a business ticket to Brisbane. So now I have to get another flight. So I have to buy another flight to Melbourne. But yes, unfortunately, mine was a pretty emotional trip back home. It wasn't nice leaving, but I'm kind of stuck between two worlds. I've got my two young children who are in Melbourne, who obviously need me. And my husband has been holding the fort. We run our own business, so he's been doing that, and he's been doing the school runs and taking them to their activities after school. And just, you know, he's been my rock. He's been fantastic. They're actually going to come up and meet me, so they're going to fly up, and we're going to have a little holiday on the Gold Coast here because it's school holidays at the moment. So it'll be nice. The kids don't know that I'm actually back, so it's going to be a big surprise for them.
Aww. That is so great. Let me turn to you then, Amanda. What took you to the hotel?
I actually went to university in Glasgow in Scotland. And when I graduated 2 years ago, I came back home. Home meaning Malaysia. My parents, they still live there. And so I went back home, and then I kind of got stuck because of the whole lockdown and COVID. So I've been there since the whole lockdown, but as a yoga instructor, and I'm also a singer and a performer. I want to move back to the UK at some point, but at the moment, still the theaters and the industry is still quite, is suffering, is closed. And so in the meantime, for a few months at least, I got a special visa to go to Bali and work on my yoga as an instructor, as a yogi. They have a lot of things going there with workshops and courses still. So I know I can work on those things, you know, while I'm waiting. So I'm trying to just make the best out of the situation.
My goodness, what a beautiful place, Bali, I have to say.
I know.
I can't imagine going there to do yoga. It sounds amazing. And we've all read Eat, Pray, Love, right? but let me turn to Charlotte. Charlotte, tell us why you are in that hotel right now.
So a little bit of a backstory. So I met my partner, who's a Kiwi, in New Zealand while I was traveling the North Island in 2019. And for a while, we did long distance and we went back and forth between the two countries. And then in January
between
of
Australia
last year...
And New Zealand.
Sorry. Yes, that's correct. And then last year, I moved over to New Zealand to be with him. And then, yeah, so just before Christmas, I wanted to go home to see my family because it was such a tough time being away from them for so long. And, yeah, so basically I got stuck back home, and it's only been until now that I was able to return to New Zealand.
So, you know, I was reading the other day that they're going to have a bubble between Australia and New Zealand, when it, like a travel bubble, shall we say. But that's, I suppose that hasn't come into operation yet. That's why you have to quarantine, I imagine.
That's correct. However, on the day that I arrived here, they announced the date of the Trans-Tasman bubble, and it's 1 day before I'm released from quarantine.
Oh,
so, if I had waited, but never mind.
I mean, New Zealand and Australia, I think they were probably among the first to kind of have the quarantine hotels, and I think probably among the strictest lockdowns. But when you go to New Zealand then, Charlotte, what's the situation, I suppose, is what I'm asking, because there's so many of our listeners that are in places that are with severe restrictions, lockdown surges, etc. And I think it might be interesting for them to hear what sort of world awaits you when you do get out of that hotel and go to see your partner.
So life in Australia and in New Zealand is pretty much the same. It feels basically like there's no COVID-19 at all. We're still able to work and, you know, go to the gym and do everything that we would normally in our day-to-day life. So, yeah, it's fantastic.
Wow, that's really quite something to think about. Amanda, you were talking about that yoga workshops, etc., are continuing in Bali. So do you know what the picture will be like there?
Yeah, it's going to be very similar to Malaysia. We've had this rule of having masks and social distancing since the whole start of lockdown. So anywhere public, you know, where you're sitting, dining in or whatever, you have to keep distance and you have to wear masks. They take your temperature. You sign in wherever you go. And so you can still go to classes, but of course there's a maximum capacity. And yeah, so gyms and things are open. But again, it's all about being smart and sanitized and distant. And they have a curfew as well, actually, in Bali. So there's no like partying going on at the moment, which is fine for me because I'm not there for that.
I understand. Well, Michelle, it must be strange as well. You say you're going to go on holiday afterwards, which is terrific. So I imagine that sounds like things are pretty open. And you're coming from Northern Ireland, where things are still rather restricted. It's like going into a different world, like, and the limbo or the purgatory is the hotel.
It is completely, it's a completely different world, being back home in Ireland, in the lockdown, and especially in winter in the cold months. Although I just kept to my bubble, but I could see the difference. I could see the impact that it was having on you know, other family members, and with, especially with kids and, you know, everyone around, and me thinking, me knowing the fact that when I go back to Australia, it almost seemed unfair. I almost felt a little bit of guilt coming back here because everything is so open here, and you know, I'm coming back to the sun, beaches, and you know, I can go out and walks and hikes and everything. You know, it's just so different.
Maybe don't FaceTime them from the beach. Have cranky family members on your case.
Exactly.
Let us finish with Amanda. Amanda, you mentioned that you're a yogi, but also that you sing. So I think we'll get a little bit of singing to finish off our conversation. And I wish you all that the next few days go in very quickly and peacefully. Get the rest, get the jobs done, and then get out to freedom.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I decided to sing a few lines of Think of Me from The Phantom of the Opera. I feel like a lot of us know that one. And I studied musical theater. That is my background. So it's a lovely song for me and has a great intention and meaning behind it. I think it's quite relevant at the moment. So I'll just sing a few lines of that. Think of me. Think of me fondly when we said goodbye. Remember me once in a while. Please promise me you'll try. When you find that once again you long to take your heart back and be free. If you ever find a moment, spare a thought for me.
Let's have an entire performance. Quarantina's Charlotte, Michelle and Amanda speaking to Nuala. Let's play you a message from another Quarantina.
Hi, my name is Madison and I'm currently in a 14-day mandatory hotel quarantine in Sydney, Australia. I'm with my husband and we're going on our 8th day now and we have 6 more to go and then we're free at 4 a.m. on the 15th day. To say we are counting down the days is an understatement. I mean, this is a super unique situation to be in. It's extremely challenging to be confined to a room for this amount of time. But we did get lucky. We were able to upgrade to get a balcony and a bigger room, so at least we get to have fresh air every day. Our hotel is very nice, clean, and comfortable. The man who checked us in was extremely nice. When he delivers any packages we get, he says hello from a distance, and it's the small things like that that help keep you from going insane. This quarantine is definitely something we will remember forever. It has changed us, challenged us, and helped us grow, and definitely made us more appreciative of our freedom.
James Reynolds with you on OS from the BBC World Service. Let's take a look at some of the stories being worked on by colleagues. Will Smith's slavery film, Emancipation, has pulled out of filming in the southern state of Georgia over what the star has called the state's new regressive voting laws. Some campaigners feel the new law will restrict voting by disadvantaged groups. A police officer in the state of Virginia has been fired after pointing a gun at and pepper spraying a black U.S. Army lieutenant during a traffic stop. Army 2nd Lieutenant Caron Nazario is wearing his uniform in body cam footage of the incident, which was filmed in December. Lieutenant Nazario filed a lawsuit against the two officers this week. And French lawmakers have moved to ban short-haul internal flights where train alternatives exist. It's in a bid to reduce carbon emissions. Over the weekend, the lawmakers voted in favour of a bill to end routes where the same journey could be made by train in under 2.5 hours. The planned measures will face a further vote in the Senate before becoming law. to India now, which has become the country with the second highest number of cases of COVID-19 in the world when measured by official tallies. The total number of cases is now 13.5 million. India's only behind the United States when it comes to that number. This week, we're going to be hearing from journalists from around India about how their own respective states are being affected by this second wave of the virus. On Monday, millions of people gathered in the northern state of Uttarakhand for a major religious festival. We're going to be speaking to two journalists in this segment. In a little bit, we're going to be speaking to Tazeen Qureshi. First of all, Ishita Mishra. Hi, Ishita.
Hi.
Now, let's talk about this festival. What do we know about what happened today?
So if you go by the figures shared by the district administration in Haridwar, where there is a religious festival, we call it Kumbh, is going on. Over 3 million people were there in Haridwar today. And they were from every part of the country. We have seen that COVID protocols were actually gone for a toss there.
They were allowed to travel from across the country, 3 million people?
Right. Yes. So 3 million people were allowed to travel from as far as 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers. And though the state government has made it mandatory to have an RT-PCR negative report to visit Haridwar during Kumbh, but still, when I see that somebody getting tested 72 hours prior to traveling, and then he is traveling, getting exposed to the virus and then reaching to a spot, I personally do not find the importance of RT-PCR in that case.
Can you explain a little bit more about what the festival is and why it's so important?
So as per a legend, when Hindu gods attempted to save the divine pot from demon, the nectar fell at various places in India, basically at 4 places. And this is where the festival of Kumbh take place in the cycle of 12 years. People believe that it wash away their sins if they take holy dip in the water of sacred river during Kumbh. So Kumbh happens in 4 places, that is Nasik, Haridwar, Prayagraj and Ujjain. The festival is important in Hinduism as large number of saints gather at Kumbh at one place, spreading and sharing the teachings of religion. Approximately 50 million people have gathered in Allahabad during Earth Kumbh in 2019. And even in Uttarakhand, even amid pandemic, around 3.5 million have gathered here today.
We've seen in other countries over the past year that religious festivals, national festivals for many different religions in many different countries have been suspended or cancelled altogether. But that this festival is going ahead?
Yes, though the government has claimed to be making a lot of preparations for Kumbh, it's actually a 4-month-long festival which has been curtailed for 1 month. This is the biggest achievement the government in India and in Uttarakhand is claiming, that rather starting Kumbh from the month of January, they have started it in April and it will last till April 30th. But even when the duration was curtailed, I do not think that the protocols of social distancing, wearing masks, and the spread of the virus was checked anywhere.
Can you remind us what the situation is like with COVID in your state?
So, yes, like every other state in India and even in the world, Uttarakhand is also witnessing the second wave of COVID-19, and over 1,000 cases are being reported here on a daily basis. It's a very small hill state in India with a very small population. Though the government has announced things like night curfew, so the people movement is restricted on roads between 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. That too in state capital. There is no restrictions in hills or in many other districts. The markets are open and you can easily see people gathering in large numbers during daytime.
Fascinating to hear. Ishita Mishra, for the moment, thank you very much. Well, let's stay in India, but go to the east of the country and speak to another journalist, Tazeen Qureshi, a freelance journalist in Odisha, in the east of the country. Tazeen, how are you?
Hi, good evening. I'm good. Thank you.
What's the COVID situation like? You heard what Ishita was saying where she is. What's the situation like where you are?
Well, to talk about Odisha, just to give you a little perspective, I'm talking about a state which is known to face a lot of natural disasters over the year. Even last year, when there was pandemic going on, it faced Cyclone Amphan, which was one of the fiercest cyclones. Before that, it was Cyclone Fani. So given the state's history, it is known to have tackled a lot of natural disasters over the years. But now we are talking about pandemic, which is honestly to say very different. And in fact, there is no comparison. But because this state has some sort of understanding about how the preparation should be by dealing with such kind of disasters or large-scale pandemic. So for that, in Uttarakhand, where there is a large-scale festival, religious festival...
Dazeen, I must say, you're doing heroically on a really terrible phone line. We did get most of what you had to say, but I think, Ashita, are you still with us?
Yes.
Yeah, lovely. We'll come back to you while we have a look at Dazeen's phone line. So talking about Dehradun, the capital of Uttarakhand. Remind us in Uttarakhand how vaccinations are going. That's the one question I didn't get to with you beforehand.
Yeah. So basically, Uttarakhand has a population of 10 million and just 2% of the population is fully vaccinated here. The vaccination started in India on January 16 and so is in the state. I should say that over 1 million people have received both shot of vaccines. So I would say that 1 million people are fully vaccinated in the state.
How are they getting on with their lives? If you're fully vaccinated in that state, what can and what can't you do?
So, though even after people, basically the people who are fully vaccinated are 100% doctors or frontline workers. And when we say frontline workers, this includes people work with the government, in the police, in the health department and things like that. So, and yes, there are cases where even people who are fully vaccinated and even have covered that particular period after vaccination when the government claims that antibody in will form, there are cases where doctors caught the virus again. They are again infected even after the two doses of vaccination.
Well, that's a very interesting thing. We will look into that. But Ashita, more generally, talk to us about the politics of pandemic restrictions in the state. Is this become an issue of political conflict?
There are obviously the political rallies are going on across country. You can see there are elections in many states. Uttarakhand has also faced the political turmoil in the month of March, where the chief minister has to resign. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's chief minister has to resign, and there is another chief minister has come in from the same party. And then there were rallies and welcoming functions and whatnot, where obviously the COVID-19 protocols were not followed by the political parties as well. Yes, when the opposition Congress is always in the attack mode to the ruling government, that it has totally failed to control COVID and all. And being a hill state, I can tell you that the healthcare services are terrible in hill states in India, because the hills are so remote that giving access to proper healthcare to people living in hills is impossible.
Ashita Mishra from the Times of India in Uttarakhand, thank you so much. And also heroically to Dazeen Qureshi, who struggled with a difficult phone line from the state of Odisha in eastern India. You're listening to OS from the BBC World Service.
Support for WMNF comes from our members and Frog Song Organics. Each week, Frog Song Organics delivers healthy produce and pasture-raised meats directly to homes and businesses in the Tampa Bay area. More at frogsongorganics.com, featuring seasonal crops, online shopping, and CSA. Queen says no to pot-smoking FBI members.
Cause you're sweet and lovely, girl, it's true. I love you more than ever, girl.
This is WMNF Tampa, 88.5 on the left side of your dial. Best little radio station on planet Earth. Stay tuned for NPR News, and then Sean will be in with Midpoint.
James got nothing on this, baby.